Okay. This is Book of Joshua Overview Part 2. Today's February 29th. My watch said it was March 1st, but I'm pretty sure it's really February 29th. So we have to start by mentioning last week you had empirical evidence that you should be a Berean, always examining everything against the Scriptures, as I read from that mysterious chapter of the Bible, Deuteronomy 35. Okay, that was only Deuteronomy 35 in my imagination, because I use the online Bible that, you know, just sort of said, it said, had the chapter heading at the top, but then just verse numberings, and it was started on 34, and of course the next chapter was 35, and I said, oh, this is the same as Joshua 1, which was true. It was. Deuteronomy 35 is exactly the same as Joshua 1. So, but you'll find in your Bibles the book of Deuteronomy only goes to 34. So. So hopefully I'll learn how to use the online Bible a little better, and we'll see. I was really happy that I'd actually gotten the NKJV version, you know, paid for it, unlocked it, could use it, copy and paste and everything. But, and I was working this week on it, and somewhere along the line I had, you know, I'm in the middle of editing stuff, and I had, I don't know, Ephesians or Acts or something up and pasted in some text, and I looked, I'm like, no, that's not Ephesians 2, that's Acts 2 or whatever it was. So I got distracted while I was editing, so hopefully all the citations today will actually be from the correct place in the Bible. Really, hopefully none of them like came from the Apocrypha accidentally or something like that. Okay. So I've got a note to myself which never was finished, to talk a little bit about the military strategy. I passed out maps last week. I may have one or two more. Let me mention just briefly here that the Israelites crossed the River Jordan across from Jericho. Okay, and Jericho's, you know, is below sort of a ridge of mountains that runs parallel to Jordan, right? The River Jordan's in a valley. And there's I guess an old path from Jericho up to Ai, and Ai's more or less along the ridge, and there's a road from there that goes north and south. So what will happen is that they'll take Jericho, and then after some trouble take Ai, and then they'll have a northern campaign and a southern campaign from there, and that will, we'll talk about that later. But that's actually what's going to happen from a sort of military standpoint. Okay, so today I'd like to briefly mention the words typology, type, and anti-type. Okay, the word, I said something about this last week, the word type comes from the Greek word, which looks to me like typos, but I'm sure I'm pronouncing it wrong. So if there's any Greek experts in the audience, you can correct me. It's used by Paul, for example, in Romans 5:14. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those who had not sinned according to the likeness of the transgression of Adam, who is a type of him who was to come. Okay, so Adam is a type of Christ, and Christ is the antitype of Adam. Okay, and typology, of course, is the study of types. This word type, it might be a little ambiguous. It has a sort of a theological meaning, which is what I'm getting at here. When if we just said, you know, that Jeff is a type of a covenanter, you know, might mean he has some specific, you know, he's a covenanter, he has certain attributes or certain distinctives or something. But here it actually means something somewhat different. So type is a, from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, a person, event, or thing that is so fashioned or pointed as to resemble another. The one is made to answer to the other in some essential feature. In some particulars, the one matches the other. So I'm not an expert on typology or the son of an expert on typology, nor do I play a typology expert on TV. But the book of Joshua is very rich in types, and I intend to mention some as we go along. So I thought it might be worthwhile saying just a little bit about types here. Okay, not the least of which is that Joshua is a type of Christ. And, you know, as with anything else, there are at least two sort of errors we could fall into in regards to typology. We could either make everything, you know, no matter how absurd, into a type, right, and sort of take it too far in that direction, or extend the meaning of our types too far, right? Adam is a type of Christ. Adam sinned, Christ didn't. I mean, it's not, you know, when we say Adam's a type of Christ, we don't mean that he was exactly like Christ, but rather that he foreshadowed Christ in some respects. And so I guess one way you could take things too far, the other way is to assume there are no types except those that are explicitly mentioned in the New Testament. So again, from the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed under the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon which whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." Okay, so this, you know, is from about the same time period. Shortly before the part that we're covering, the Bible, Paul gives us both the typological application, right? The rock that they drank from was Christ. He also gives us several practical applications. Don't lust after evil things. Do not become idolaters. Don't complain. All right? And so when we're studying Joshua, we might also try to understand some of its typological applications and also its practical applications. And maybe like Paul, we should try to find three practical applications for every typological application. I say that because, of course, we don't want to reduce the book solely to some theoretical typological applications, which I guess would be possible if you would prefer to dwell on those things rather than our own sins and shortcomings that the book might call attention to. There's a fairly lengthy description by Patrick Fairbairn of how the earthly Canaan, the promised land, how it was typical here, and I wrote out, or actually put in a quite long quote, which is probably too long to read. He says, of course, that, well, let me just try to hit a few highlights, and I think I may read the last paragraph. But he says, "The earthly Canaan wasn't designed by God to be the ultimate proper inheritance to which the saints were to occupy." And he says that the ultimate inheritance, it says, can only be man's original possession restored, the earth redeemed from the curse which sin brought on it, and like man himself be the fit abode of a church made like in all members to the Son of God. And he says that it's the occupation of the earthly Canaan by the natural seed of Abraham was a type, and no more than a type, of this occupation by a redeemed church of her destined inheritance of glory. Consequently, everything concerning the entrance of the former on their temporary possession was ordered so as to represent and foreshadow the things which belong to the church's establishment in her permanent possession. Okay, so he claims that this conquest of the promised land is a type of the church's conquest and redeeming of the earth and the inheritance of the church's possession. He then goes on to ask why, you know, all these things happened, and said that in order to understand this, you have to understand what it's pointing to. And just this last paragraph here, the whole series of transactions which took place between the confirmation of the covenant of promise with Jacob and the actual possession of the land promised, and especially, of course, the things which concern the greatest of all the transactions, the revelation of the law from Sinai, is to be regarded as a delineation of the type of the way and manner which the heirs of God are to obtain the inheritance of the purchased possession. Meanwhile, there are two important lessons which the church may clearly gather, which she ought never to lose sight of. First, that the inheritance, come when and how it may, is the free gift of God, bestowed by him as sovereign Lord and proprietor on those whom he calls to the fellowship of his grace. Second, that the hope of the inheritance must exist as an animating principle in their hearts, influencing all their procedure. Their spirit and character must be such as those who are expectants, as well as heirs of that better country, which isn't heavenly. Nor can Christ ever be truly formed in the heart until he is formed as the hope of glory. Okay, so we left off last time, having gotten all the way through, what was it, 2 chapters of Joshua? And Jeff's rapid overview of the book helped as part of our survey. We left off across the Jordan from Jericho, and pick it up here. Should be Joshua 3, but as I see in my notes, I didn't actually print out the chapter. I think I better open up my physical Bible and make sure before I go off and tell you. Yes, it is Joshua 3. Okay, well, let's read a little bit from this. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Acacia Grove and came to the Jordan. He and all the children of Israel lodged there before they crossed over. So it was after 3 days that the officers went through the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God and the priests, the Levites, bearing it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. Yet there shall be a space between you and it, about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you must go, for you have not passed this way before." Joshua said to the people, "Sanctify yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." Then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over before the people." So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. You shall command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, 'When you come to the edge of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan.'" So Joshua said to the children of Israel, "Come here and hear the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua said, "By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is crossing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from every tribe. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, that the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap." So it was when the people set out from their camp to cross over the Jordan, with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people. And as those who bore the Ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the Ark dipped in the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, that the waters which came down from upstream stood still, and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zeratim. So the waters that went down into the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off. And the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people crossed completely over the Jordan. Okay, and it goes on then in chapter 4 to talk about how Joshua instructs the Israelites to... They select 12 men. The Lord says to Joshua, tells him to select 12 men to carry 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan and carry them out and make a memorial. And they also place 12 stones in the Jordan. So, after leaving Acacia Grove, Joshua, he leads the people to the Jordan River, and they then encamp for 3 days. And I guess they wondered how they were going to get across the river. They had, you know, So, you know, why did God leave them there for 3 days? Well, you know, perhaps it was for the very reason they needed to trust in him. To stare sort of at this obstacle for 3 days rather than just march up to it and cross without giving any thought to what they were going to do. The night before, they were told to sanctify themselves. They were then told they should watch for the Ark of the Covenant and set out. The Ark contained the testimony, the law, had on top the mercy seat, upon which once a year was made propitiation for the people's sins. According to Hebrews 9, Christ fulfills that role as the perfect high priest who's made, you know, once and final propitiation for our sins. So, you know, drawing one practical application from this is that as we go to take possession of the promised land, that we should fix our eyes on Christ. And sanctify ourselves and fix our eyes on Christ. The crossing itself was, of course, very reminiscent of the crossing of the Red Sea. Some of the people who crossed over would have been those who crossed the Red Sea as children. Okay, most would have only heard about it. There's a continuity between the Pentateuch here and the book of Joshua. God's power demonstrated in both cases in a very remarkable way that was similar. It was witnessed by the whole nation of Israel. They all passed through with dry feet. There are also some interesting differences, right? The crossing of the Red Sea marked the ending of the Israelites' bondage. The crossing of the Jordan marked their entrance into the Promised Land. One crossing allowed their escape from a following army, and the other one facilitated their conquering of many armies. The first one happened at night, the second in broad daylight. In the first crossing, the Israelites' enemies, the Egyptians, saw this and they were spurred on to action. Like, let's, you know, basically we'll chase them and, you know, we'll get them. And in the second crossing, the Israelites' or enemies' hearts were faint. In fact, they sort of shut up in the cities with their knees trembling, knees knocking. So as a result, in the first crossing, the Israelites saw as a memorial of sorts the dead bodies of the Egyptians washed up on shore. And in the latter, they saw only these memorial stones that they placed. I guess in a similar way to Moses' leadership being validated, we're told specifically in Joshua 3:7 that this was a validation of Joshua's leadership before the people. And to give you sort of a typical application, this is a quote from Arthur Pink, The Color of Our Directories. But we must be careful lest we overlook something far more glorious than what has just been pointed out. Surely those words, "This day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel," should at once turn our thoughts to one infinitely superior to Joshua. That what God did here for his servant was a foreshadowment of what later he did to his son at the same Jordan. No sooner was our blessed Lord baptized in that river than, lo, the heavens were opened unto him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting upon him. And lo, a voice from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." Then was he, quote, made manifest to Israel. Then was he authenticated for his great mission. Then did God begin to magnify him. Still more wonderful is the type when we observe at what part of the Jordan this occurred. These things were done in Bethabara, which signified, quote, the place of passage, so that Christ was attested by the Father at the very place where Israel passed through the river and where Joshua was magnified. I tried to do a little more research on this. I'm not sure it's absolutely clear that it's definitely the place, but it, you know, it sounds like it was, and you know, it makes sense. So, okay. So then the Israelites, as commanded, set up 12 stones in the Jordan and brought 12 stones out to make a memorial on dry land. And the stones were there to instruct future generations, and for that matter, to instruct the generation that passed through the Jordan. Drawing an application here is that God's ordering, and this is, again, a quote from Pink, God's ordering of this memorial is a solemn reminder of how prone our hearts are to forget his past interpositions on our behalf. But Israel, we are told, that they forgot his works and his wonders that he showed them. And again, that they soon forgot his works. And alas, is not the same true of us. A little later, I noticed Pink says that the monument erected at Gilgal teaches us that we should take thought of and seek to make provision for the rising generation. So, I don't know, you know, with respect to a church building, maybe we should be thinking about this. Okay. Cemetery, yeah. Isn't that the provision for the falling generation?
Yeah.
Okay. In Joshua 4:17, we're told that the Israelites... Well, this is good. Did I say 17? Here you go again. Yeah, Deuteronomy 3. Exactly. 19. Okay, it's 19. Now the people came up from Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. So, can anyone tell me the significance of that day? It's related to the Passover. It's the day that the Israelites were to select a lamb for the Passover celebration. The Passover celebration occurred on the 14th day. So in God's perfect timing, they crossed over right before the time for the Passover celebration, which they hadn't kept while they were in the desert. Nor they kept the other sacrament that was given by God, circumcision. So just as there were two stone memorials, there were two living signs, circumcision and Passover. Before they could keep the Passover, they had to be circumcised. Now, militarily speaking, performing a mass circumcision probably wouldn't have been classified as a wise thing to do right when you crossed over into enemy territory. The Canaanites had attacked then, physically speaking, they would have found the Israelites somewhat incapacitated. But in God's plan, though, the Canaanites were shut up in their cities, panicked. Okay, so circumcision was a sign of the covenant given to Abraham's descendants. And until the men were circumcised, they weren't ready to fight the battles of the Lord. Just as Moses wasn't ready to lead God's people until he had his own son circumcised. If you remember, he was headed back to Egypt, and God threatened to kill him on the road until his wife intervened and circumcised the sons. So when Passover was established 500 years later, all the males of the household eating the Passover were to be circumcised. And if a stranger wanted to keep the Passover, all the males of his household were to be circumcised. The place was called Gilgal. It's literally meaning a rolling. It was a rolling away of the reproach of Egypt. For they had been slaves in Egypt, they were now going on to possess their God-given promised land. Okay, so they were circumcised, and then they went ahead and celebrated the Passover. Ceremony which looked back both to their deliverance one generation ago from the Egyptians and forward to Christ, the perfect Passover lamb whose blood saves. So, and after I mentioned this last week that Christ appears in the book. After the Passover celebration is reported, it's here in the narrative that Joshua meets Christ. And this is 5:13. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" So he said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Lord I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. I don't think there's very much question about this being Christ. That seems to be widely agreed to, and we could probably discuss the reasons for that. But, among other places in the scriptures where an angel appears and is worshipped, he says, don't worship me. And that wasn't the response of this. The commander of the Lord's army. So, pretty clearly we could take from this that this fight that the Israelites were on was commanded by the Lord, and in fact, it's really wasn't even their own quarrel, as it were, in which they should be asking for divine help. Rather, they were basically a division of the Lord, of the host of the Lord. it wasn't, this destruction of Canaan wasn't some private matter that the Israelites were just wanted to get even with the Canaanites, right? It was God's judgment on the Canaanites. And that's why they were in Egypt for several hundred years, because the iniquities of the Canaanites hadn't yet come to the full, but now they had. Okay. So, we come then to Joshua chapter 6, and reminded of Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord builds its house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Well, here's a very clear case of where the watchman was staying awake in vain. So, again, let me read this. This is one of my many favorite stories out of the book of Joshua. Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the 7th day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up, every man straight before him." Then Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, "Take up the Ark of the Covenant, and let 7 priests bear 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord." And he said to the people, "Proceed and march around the city, and let him who is armed advance before the Ark of the Lord." So it was when Joshua had spoken to the people that the 7 priests bearing the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets. And the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came up after the Ark, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, "You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout it." So he had the Ark of the Lord circle the city, going around at once. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the Ark of the Lord. Then 7 priests, bearing 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord, went on continually and blew with the trumpets. And the armed men went before them. But the rear guard came after the Ark of the Lord, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the 2nd day they marched around the city once and returned to camp. So they did 6 days. But it came to pass on the 7th day that they rose early about the dawning of the day and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city 7 times. And the 7th time it happened, when the priest blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you, by all means, abstain from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel accursed and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord." So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets. And it happened, when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkey, with the edge of the sword. But Joshua had said to the 2 men who had spied out the country, "Go into the harlot's house, and from there bring out the woman and all that she has, as you swore to her." And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought out all her relatives and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Then Joshua charged them at that time, saying, "Cursed be the man before the Lord who rises up and builds the city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up its gates." So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout all the country. Okay, this is, of course, one of the great well-known stories of the Bible, not just of the book of Joshua. And much, much might be made out of it, especially if we weren't supposed to be on an overview. let me bring out a few things. Again, a quote from Pink. He's commenting on the fact that the Lord has proclaimed that Jericho is being handed over to the Israelites for destruction. The Lord tells Joshua that, and then he gives them orders for marching around it 7 days. Right, so he says, I'm going to give this over, to you for destruction, and here's what you're going to do. You're going to march around it for 7 days, right? So Pink says, if the Lord had definitely given Jericho into the hands of Joshua, why were such elaborate preparations as these necessary for its overthrow? Let those who feel the force of any such difficulty weigh attentively what we are about to say. In reality, those verses exemplify and illustrate a principle which is most important for us to apprehend. That principle may be stated thus. The disclosure of God's gracious purpose and the absolute certainty of its accomplishment in no wise renders needless the discharge of our responsibilities. God's assuring us of the sureness of the end does not set aside the indispensability of the use of the means. Skipping ahead a little bit, so far from the divine promises being designed to promote inactivity on our part, they are given as a spur unto the same to assure us that if our efforts square with the divine rule, they will not be in vain. The gracious declaration that God had given Jericho into the hand of Israel did not discharge them from the performance of their duty, but was to assure them of certain success in the same. That principle operates throughout in the accomplishment of the divine purpose. The truth of election is not revealed in order to license a spirit of fatalism, but to rejoice our hearts by the knowledge that the whole of Adam's race is not doomed to destruction. Nor are the elect mechanically delivered from destruction apart from any action of theirs, for though they be, quote, chosen to salvation, yet it is through sanctification of the spirit and belief of the truth. Unless the truth be embraced by them, no salvation be theirs, for he that believeth not shall be damned. So, regarding typology and symbolism, it might be noted that the Ark of the Covenant with them represents the Lord's presence with them. The priests carrying the trumpet represent God's messengers. The trumpet is often a symbol for preaching and prophesying in the Bible. And again, from Pink, the sounding of the trumpets by the priests on this occasion had a twofold design: to strike terror into the hearts of the Canaanites, to inspire with courage and confidence the people of God. And that is the twofold work of Christ's servants. First, to solemnly declare the revealed wrath of God against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. And then he goes on, and of course also then to proclaim the gospel. So, and to encourage the saints in their conflict with the flesh, the world, and the devil. So, finally, it took faith for the Israelites to carefully conform themselves to God's will and directives. We're told in Hebrews 11, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish for those who did not believe, when she had received the spies with peace. Okay. So, they're victorious at Jericho. Chapter 7 starts with the word, but. Okay. So, reading verses 1 to 5, but the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things, for Achan the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. So the anger of the Lord burned against the children of Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Beth-Aven, on the east side of Bethel, and spoke to them, saying, go up and spy out the country. So the men went up and spied out Ai, and they returned to Joshua and said to him, do not let all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not weary all the people there, for the people of Ai are few. So about 3,000 men went up there from the people, but they fled before the men of Ai. And the men of Ai struck down about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate as far as Shabarim, and struck them down on the descent. Therefore the hearts of the people melted and became like water. Okay, so things here turned out somewhat differently. As Achan had disobeyed God, he took for himself something that was to be wholly devoted to God. Okay, Achan was stealing from God. This is quite serious sin, right? And we find the reminder of this with the story of Ananias and Sapphira. Francis Schaeffer also points out that besides gold and silver, and we have a little further details what he actually took. He took gold and silver and a Babylonian garment. The text says a beautiful Babylonian garment. Schaeffer points out that anything from Babylon was chic. You know, this was not like old shepherd's clothes. These were like, you were the man if you had something from Babylonian clothes. Certainly something to think about in terms of our own pride. You know, sort of puts a different, take on this. Also, the Israelites had been commanded not to, as we just read, not to take anything from Jericho. They were to burn everything except the gold and silver, which was supposed to be put into the treasury of the Lord. But that was not a command that was going to apply for the rest of the campaign, right? So in fact, Jericho being the first fruits, the tithe as it were, they were supposed to give it all to the Lord. After this, they were going to be allowed to plunder. So in one sense, Achan had become impatient, hadn't waited on God's timing, started taking matters into his own hands. Now, if you think about it, if he hadn't taken it, then presumably they would have gone on to Ai, been victorious, and there would have been a lot of plunder to go around. Furthermore, it seems likely that in this case, a little leaven has leavened the whole lump. Right. I see Xiao down there looking quizzically at me. Right, this is a biblical metaphor for based on yeast being worked through a lump of dough, and it's often applied to a little bit of evil sort of works its way through the whole mass. Right, the spies came back with some rather poor advice. It seems likely it was motivated by pride and arrogance. You know, it's possible it was motivated by faith. You know, God is so great that, you know, only 3,000 men surely would be sufficient. This seems unlikely, you know, given the outcome and so on. But anyways, the text doesn't really say what their motivation was. Likewise, Joshua took the advice. Why? It seemed directly contrary to the way God had worked at Jericho when he sent out all of Israel. I wonder why, in Numbers 3:21, it was said of Joshua, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. All at his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in. He and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. From what we can tell in the text, it looks like Joshua didn't inquire of the Lord. So they set out, 3,000 men, and they were soundly defeated. On the basis of the sort of typical significance of the book, right? Israel's conquest being a type of the church's conquest and Christians' conquest or occupation by faith of our heavenly heritage. The passage really bears some further study, but one sort of practical application we might draw out is that when God has blessed and prospered us, we at that time we might be at our sort of greatest danger of presuming on God. Okay. So, let's see. Joshua, let me read a little bit more from 7. Joshua 7, starting in verse 6. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on the face before the ark of the Lord until evening, he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, Alas, Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all, to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Oh, that we had been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. O Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns its back before its enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it and surround us and cut off our name from the earth. Then what will you do for your great name? So the Lord said to Joshua, Get up. Why do you lie thus on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant which I commanded them. For they have even taken some of the accursed things and have both stolen and deceived, and they have put it among their own stuff. Therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turned their backs before their enemies, because they became doomed to destruction. Neither will I be with you any more unless you destroy the accursed from among you. Get up, sanctify the people, and say, Sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, because thus says the Lord God of Israel, There is an accursed thing in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the accursed thing from among you. In the morning, therefore, you shall be brought according to your tribes, and it shall be that the tribe which the Lord takes shall come according to families. The family which the Lord takes shall come by households, and the household which the Lord takes shall come man by man. Then it shall be that he who is taken with the accursed thing shall be burned with fire, he and all that he has, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord, because he has done a disgraceful thing in Israel. So Joshua rose early in the morning and brought Israel by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. He brought the clan of Judah, and he took the family of the Zarahites, and he brought the family of the Zarahites man by man, and Zabdi was taken. Then he brought his household man by man, and Achan the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah was taken. Now Joshua said to Achan, "My son, I beg you, give glory to the Lord God of Israel, and make confession to him. And tell me now what you have done, do not hide it from me." And Achan answered Joshua and said, "Indeed, I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel, and this is what I have done. When I saw among the spoils a beautiful Babylonian garment, 200 shekels of silver, and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. And there they are, hidden in the earth, in the midst of my tent, with the silver under it." So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and there it was, hidden in his tent, with the silver under it. And they took them from the midst of the tent, and brought them to Joshua and to all the children of Israel, and laid them out before the Lord. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah, the silver, the garment, the wedge of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that they had, and they brought him to the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day." So all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire, after they had stoned them with stones. Then they raised over him a great hope of heap of stones, still there to this day. So the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day. So, God was rather brusque with Joshua. He was even more brusque with Achan. Again, there's probably quite a bit we could draw from this. What I really wanted to do today was, I think we will, we'll just go on to the fall of Ai. God then told Joshua what to do, right? After judgment, Lord spoke to Joshua. He told him to take all the people of war with you and rise, go up to Ai. He tells him that he's given it in, given into Joshua's hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land, and you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. Only its spoil and its cattle, you shall take as booty for yourselves. Lay an ambush for the city behind it. Okay, so if you follow on in chapter 8, it transpires that God told Joshua basically to lay an ambush. They go and attack the city, they retreat, and then they stream into the city and burn it, and it's a great victory. Here's a case where in Jericho God used sort of very, say, miraculous means or very special means, and here's a case where God basically used what I call a pretty standard military strategy. Right? This sort of thing is still used today in small unit operations, right? It ends with the city captured, the livestock and spoil of the city was taken as booty, the king of Ai was hanged on a tree until evening. And then they took his corpse down, and they raised over it a great heap of stones that remains to this day. Not a living memorial this time, but another memorial. So we'll stop there, and I hope to finish next week, but never know. So let's see. Are there any questions?